Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in May 2025. Now, we know that HFSS regulations are reshaping how food manufacturers approach product development, marketing, and consumer engagement. With advertising restrictions coming into force and complex compliance requirements, the industry faces unprecedented challenges in navigating this regulatory landscape. So how do we balance nutritional reformulation with consumer taste preferences while staying compliant with evolving HFSS policies?
Brilliant. So I might start with each of you just introducing yourselves, the organisation you work for and the role within that. And then one major question for you all. We're talking about HFSS. What's the one common misunderstanding that you've encountered about HFSS policy and implementation, and how would you go about correcting it?
Hi, so my name is Natasha Gore. I'm a partner at DWF in the Regulatory Compliance and Investigations team. A bit of a tongue twister there. I help clients with both contentious and non-contentious matters, so that can be helping clients bring products to market, as often their packaging and labelling, or the contentious side, how can we regulate your investigations, interviews in a court, and all the way through to Crown Court trials. Taking your question, the fact that everyone thinks it applies to all categories and that it applies to all forms of marketing, I'll probably go into this a bit more detail. And again, Lewis has already done a fantastic presentation on this. It covered quite a lot of the legal points for me. Thank you. But it doesn't obviously apply to everything. And there are areas where there is scope to still do these types of adverts, but we're just going to have to be more creative in the future, I think.
Good. Fionn, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Fionn McKinwar, Senior Diet and Health Executive at the Food and Drink Federation. The Food and Drink Federation is a trade association for food and drink manufacturers in the UK, and we really support businesses across areas of government policy. In my role at FDF, I work in the Diet and Health team, so I focus on government obesity policy and how that impacts food and drink manufacturers. In terms of a common misunderstanding, I would say when it comes to promotions, HFSS promotions, is the fact that you have, it's a devolved area, so you have different regulation in England, potentially Scotland, and obviously Wales and Northern Ireland. So we already have the promotions restrictions in terms of the location base already in force in England, and we're approaching the volume-based promotions in October. In Wales, they have laid legislation for the HFSS promotions restrictions, which, as Lewis said, mirror England, which is really great to see that consistency, because it does make it a lot easier for businesses in terms of implementing it. Whereas in Scotland, we are awaiting an announcement on what the next steps are. When they did their consultation, they looked at additional volume promotions and additional locations, which I guess is a huge concern when it comes to implementing it across borders. So I think that would probably be a common misunderstanding for me. And in terms of correcting it, I mean, I would say, number one, aligning regulation across the whole of the UK. I think that'd be like a big step in correcting that.
Yeah. Thanks, Fionn. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. So hi, I'm Lauren Woodley. I'm the head of nutrition and sensory science at Nomad Foods. Nomad Foods is Europe's largest frozen food company. We're known better as Bird's Eye, Goodfellas, Aunt Bessie in the UK. But from anyone in the rest of Europe, we're Iglo, Freecom, La Cocinera, all sorts of different brands. So we're a big frozen food brand in every single market across Europe. Within my job, I look after the nutrition strategy and the sensory science strategy for the whole of the business. And we are leaders in nutrition, and we really have a nutrition mindset within our business. So my job is also to make sure that we deliver on the quite strict commitments that we make externally. To that question,
so you're not always the most popular.
No. I hope that I make people excited about nutrition, but it's not always easy what we target, for sure.
Biggest misconception at the moment?
I think the big one has been recently, it has been around what's in and out of scope. And I think really it kind of points to the way in which the media has misreported it. And this seems to be a bit of a standard pattern which we now see with obesity strategy and policies. There's misreporting through the media, public uproar, discussion about nanny state and then nothing really happens. So it's really unfortunate, and I hope that in future there'll be better media briefing, and also maybe the government could be a little bit quicker to go and sort out the problems, because I had everyone panicking at my company that fish fingers were going to be banned from any advertisements, and you can imagine the panic there.
Absolutely. Sally, you're very welcome.
Hello everybody, I'm Sally. I'm from the University of Leeds, and I lecture there on nutrition policy. I'm a registered nutritionist and a registered dietitian, and thanks for inviting me today. And what was your last question? The misconceptions. So I think labelling, I'm just thinking about my questions that the students asked me, and so they think HFSS products are labelled as such. And secondary to that, they think HFSS is somehow the same as traffic lights, which it's not. So those are my misconceptions that I get to talk about.
It's good to have access to that younger generation as well, and you know what they're interpreting. So really good insight. Lauren, I'll start with yourself, I suppose, in terms of Nomad Foods and that role of head of nutrition and sensory science. So you're really, you know, leading the way within your business in both of those areas. But how do you balance the sort of nutritional aspect and the sensory? It all comes back to the taste, doesn't it? And what models have maybe worked for you over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so caveat, I'm a month and a half into being the head of sensory science. I've looked after nutrition for a number of years, but sensory is quite new. But the balance is really important. So one of the reasons why actually our business took the decision to create a new role of head of nutrition and sensory science was to really face into this kind of perennial conflict, let's say, of taste versus health. The idea for us as a business that needs to have such a high proportion of our products being healthy is that they need to be tasty and healthy. We can't have an either or. And so my role is to really help to bridge that and kind of fight for the fact that we need to find the solutions. Sensory testing has been incredibly important to us as a business. So when we first, it's our 10-year anniversary this year, but the first year that we actually reported our sales from healthy products, non-HFSS products, we were at about 81%. 8 years down the line, we're up at about 94%, and a number of our markets have 100% non-HFSS ranges now. That's been delivered by renovation and innovation, and at the core of all of that has been sensory testing. So when you go to reformulation and nutrition optimization is important, we're also committed and targeted on that, very much looking at kind of liking testing and also difference testing, so the R-tests, the triangle tests. And then when it comes to MPD, it's making sure that actually we constantly test with the consumers to see if we've gone too far. As you can imagine, as the nutritionist, we're always pushing for a little bit less salt and a little bit more fiber, but we need to get the balance right. But sensory testing is, I believe, vital to delivering on HFSS.
And I don't always like to talk about failings, but it has come up a couple of times today. Have you pushed it too far? And is there any example in particular from any of the brands within your portfolio where actually you've learnt it the hard way, where there's been a negative on sales? And could you just talk us a little bit about what you learned from that?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we did push a little bit too far. So cream spinach is a really popular dish, especially in kind of Western Europe. So within our kind of German business, it's a huge product for us. And we had a fantastic idea to really go far and push past the salt level. So generally, the rule of thumb is about 10% reduction can be imperceptible. And if you do that over time, you get a big reduction over time. We decided to aim for more than 20% in one go. We thought we could balance the rest of the flavors using nutmeg. You can't. And we had to roll back. But also actually another example, so I worked at Unilever for a number of years as well. I used to work on pot noodle, and there was a fantastic project, reduced the salt by 30%, which was fantastic, and it almost killed that brand. So we had to roll back too. So I think stepwise improvements, constantly trying to do, is important too, because obviously our taste buds adopt over time. So little and often, small reductions is the best way.
Very good. Thank you. Natasha, I'm going to talk about, I suppose, from a legal standpoint for a moment. Where do you foresee the biggest sort of compliance risks within this space at the moment?
It's quite a loaded question. It's a really complicated area. So I think you just need to take it back to, I explained to the juniors in my team, kind of basic principles of who does it apply to and what does it apply to. So as Lewis said, there's the first thing of looking at are you even caught by these regulations? So if you've got 249 employees or less, you're not going to be caught. So the SME exemption is there, kind of putting it out in the market, which obviously large corporates are not happy about. But if you are, if you do fall in that category, then that's end of the road for you. You don't need to look at this any further. One thing to note as well is with franchisee arrangements, there's been a lot of discussion about this. It's not just on that one site alone. If you're in a franchisee arrangement, then they look at all of the franchise sites and add them all up together. And then they see if you're under 249 together and the head office, then you're okay. But if you're not, then you're caught again. So just one to be mindful of. The next thing is probably to break it down into what is covered. So again, thank you, Lewis. But I'll do a whistle-stop tour, and I'm just going to look at the stuff that's coming into play in October. So obviously, first is if you're a HFSS product. So as was outlined earlier today, you've got to look at whether you're in the schedules or the categories in the advertising regulations. They are quite wide. And there are things in there that you would expect to be seen, but there are obviously your products in there that you wouldn't expect to see. I know for myself, I've had a couple of clients recently that were looking at healthy, nutritious bars, actually, but because they use a couple of ingredients and they're in a bar form, they're then going to be caught. And they just assume they naturally wouldn't be caught because they're advertising a healthy product. But then this is the second limb that Lewis said, you have to catch both of them. So if you think you're in that first category, then you move on to step two, which is to see if you are above those levels that Lewis has outlined in his presentation earlier and the nutrient profiling model. So over four for food, over one for drink. Then it's step three. So the next question is, okay, so you're a large corporate, you've got a HFSS product. Okay, so what does your marketing look like and your advertising? Yes, it covers a lot of things. And let's be honest, for the lazy marketing and advertising, it covers the main route to market. So you're going to have to be creative. But what it doesn't cover audio, doesn't cover radio, doesn't cover, you know, outside. So posters, visual boards. It doesn't include day out experiences. You're just going to have to really think outside the box and be a bit more creative. But as I said earlier on, the misconception is that it applies to all products, to everybody, and that obviously applies to all types of marketing, which it doesn't. And then obviously the elephant in the room is this identifiability test, which obviously the legislation has referred to, but there's been a lot of noise about it through the ASA consultation and the government statement last month. So obviously, in its basic form, it's saying if a reasonable consumer watches your ad and identifies a HFSS product, it would be caught. Now, the noise has come created about where if you have a brand which is synonymous with HFSS identity, would they always be caught? And this is what the ASA have kind of alluded to in their consultation recently. Now, the government has come back and thankfully said no. Because if you were talking about things to do with, I don't know, deforestation or having a happy place to work or being, you know, a top employer, you know, that obviously, just because you've got a brand that's known for unhealthy product line, doesn't mean you can't put that on telly or, you know, at any point. So I think we're still going to have to see what's going to be captured there. And I still think we need obviously the consultation to be confirmed and the guidance to be released. And realistically, I think until this is live and we see what the regulator is going to do with this, so back end of this year, we're probably actually not going to know where the ASA are going to fall on this kind of brand advertising. And we're going to have to wait till some of those regulatory enforcement actions come through and then kind of take it on a day-by-day basis and see how strict they are with that brand.
And as a brand or a manufacturer, how do you stay kind of up to date? What's the easy kind of points of keeping up to date with what's happening? Because it is a minefield. So yeah. Where do I go if I just need to know what's happening, what's changing, or what has changed?
I think your contacts in this field are super important. Everybody's talking about this. Reach out to your network, see what people are doing. The larger brands have kind of been planning for this for a while, so are quite ahead with things. But also there's a lot about this topic. There's a lot of people talking about it. Say Lewis is out there, you know, likes of us lawyers are advising clients on it all the time and discussing what they can do to get ahead. I think it's one of the food law, we were talking about this earlier on, is so vast and so complex, but this is actually one of those areas that's got a real spotlight on it at the moment. So there's actually quite a lot of data out there, and there's a lot of people talking about it. You know, there's a lot of podcasts about it. So there's quite a lot of information to kind of get ahead of. And I think it's about kind of looking at your brand already, as, you know, Lauren, you said this earlier on, and, you know, are there products where you're only just over the nutrient profiling model. So those would be the ones where you think, okay, well, we're not going to really erode on our taste or what our customers are expecting, and maybe we could take ourselves outside of the regulations and talk with your product development teams at early doors to see if you can move yourself outside. There'll be other categories where you want to be, you know, the naughty food that people have on a nice, you know, a nice treat basis, and you know, you're scoring 28, 30 on the scale, so you've got no chance. You're going to lose your customer base. Those are the ones where I think ahead now, think about creative marketing strategies, you know, think about how you can diversify and grow your brand, but in a way that's not kind of the mainstream. You are going to have to think of different ways around it. I see a lot of clients at the moment going out to the market and doing a lot of competitions or loyalty schemes at the moment to get the customer information, because direct marketing isn't going to be banned. So when the regulations kick in, they've kind of legally gained all of their customer database information, and then they can push their HFSS products through direct marketing as well. Okay. So there are different types of strategies. It's just, we're going to have to think about it a little bit differently.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Fionn, from, I suppose, the FDF perspective and working with member companies, what have you seen as the sort of learnings around HFSS coming into play? And I suppose, what are the recurring maybe pain points as well?
Yeah, of course. So I think one of the things that we've definitely learned, which I'm sure many of you who work for a food company will know, is that healthier product innovation is very complicated and it's really not easy. Industry has made some great success in the space. We have FDF data from Kantar World Panel, which shows that since 2015, FDF members contribute about a third less salt and 25% less sugar and calories to the food and drink market, which is a great success. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that always happens and that's easy. Like Lauren was talking about, you know, it's really based on consumers a lot of the time. Consumer acceptability, because if you make a product that is very healthy but a consumer doesn't like it, then you know they're not going to buy it, and then there's risk that that product is going to be delisted. So healthier product innovation, very complicated, but also takes a lot of time and investment. We estimate that in 2023 around 160 to 190 million pounds was spent on healthier product development in the UK. So that is a huge sum of money that is, you know, continually going on. So you can see that it does require a lot of investment. And for particularly smaller companies, that can be really challenging. So in Scotland, one of the things that we've seen is the Scottish Government fund a program called Reformulation for Health, which supports small companies in terms of reformulation and innovation. So it connects them with technical expertise. It provides grants for them to do healthier development projects. And through that project, we've seen really great successes. And then we have some really great case studies from there. For example, there was a company called Tower Bakery who managed to increase the fibre in their rolls, and that was rolled out to schools. So that's a really great example of how, you know, small changes and small pots of money can really support smaller businesses. In terms of, I think, pain points, one of the things is around regulatory certainty. So we really see that with the brand advertising challenges when it comes to advertising restrictions, in that companies have been planning towards this for some time, and they were under the assumption that brand advertising will be out of scope. As many people have said, we're very uncertain if brand advertising will be out of scope, which means that certain products, say if they are a non-HFSS product, there's no certainty that they'll actually be able to advertise that despite all of that innovation and work that's gone into developing that product over time. So I think those are some of the kind of learnings and key
pain points. Brilliant. Just picking up on something that Fionn said, Sally, around collaboration, what is the role of academia? We've talked a lot about collaboration in sort of navigating our way through, and how are you approaching it?
Yeah, so I think there's a role for academia to produce some evidence that may be independent of industrial involvement in order to support public health policy and development. And of course, we do that with the intention of supporting public health, which I think is the reason we're all here and talking about HFSS, the problems we have with levels of obesity, and the, on a population level, the excessive intakes of sugars, salt, and saturated fat. So that's the spirit in which the HFSS legislation is intended. So providing data and insight to drive policy development, to make it better maybe and to go a bit further or to make it more implementable and accurately kind of targeted. And then working with industry. So I do quite a lot of this in my role. And for example, we're currently working with Ocado, the online retailer, and we are looking at consumer behaviour in online food environments. So that's a target. The online supermarket is a target of this policy where mm-hmm. Lewis showed there's certain products in certain locations online that can't be promoted as such. And we're looking at consumer behaviour with eye tracking and other methods with a kind of intention of going beyond the label and beyond relying on labelling to help consumers make informed choices, kind of moving away from, you know, putting every emphasis on the individual to make those choices, but to make that whole environment more supportive of encouraging healthier choices. There's an awful lot out there, but when you've got 3,000 products on an online supermarket web page, you know, then navigating that's pretty difficult. Yeah. So that's just one example of a partnership between our researchers and Ocado Supermarket, which is in fact funded.
Do you mind me just asking what just the early, I suppose, insights for Ocado, have they made any changes and has it proven successful or they still learning from it? Is there anything that's working that you're allowed to share?
It's still ongoing, actually, yeah. And the project's created so much data, we're still ploughing through it with a data scientist. But the funding for the project was originating from the BBSRC Consumer Lab, and it is supporting ourselves and Ocado to do the work in partnership. So those pots of money are out there, and that's a great way to foster impact of research on the retailer. And those impact points, so will the website design change in future? We're still working through that. Yeah, let's hope so.
Very good, very good. Lauren, just I know you touched on spinach in the German market. Any other examples? I suppose I'm just thinking of the teams that are in the audience around reformulating and how did you, I suppose, as a team, as a cross-functional team, because it's one of those changes in the business that's really impacting every single department. Is there learnings from any example that comes to mind for yourselves across Nomad Foods?
Yes, so apologies to those who are in the round table with me because you've heard this story before, but I'll give a bit more flavour to it. So when the HFSS restrictions were first mooted back in 2020, at that point we have our Goodfellas business. We already had a plan in place to be 50% of the recipes non-HFSS by the end of 2020. When we first acquired the business, it was about 17%, so mainly HFSS pizzas. When that regulation was announced, I decided that we should sell in getting to 100% of the pizza recipes becoming non-HFSS. And that required getting our executive board on board, then the UK board, and various levels of leadership, because obviously there was a lot of money on the line there too. By having their buy-in, that really helped then with their collaboration then with commercial teams and the R&D teams to make the project a success. We managed to achieve 100% on HFSS by the end of 2023. But it was actually by working obviously with R&D, because they had to work with quality and the sensory teams. We also had to work with the legal team. We worked with our commercial teams to sell into the retailers to promise that actually the products were still going to be bought and people still liked them. And so the collaboration there was actually really key through all parts of the business to be bought into it, because it was a big old project. Specifically from a product level, redesigning pizza, not an easy feat. I didn't do the work. I just got to kind of hear the updates and kind of motivate them to keep on going. But effectively, pizza is quite challenging because it's a composite product. And especially thinner pizzas, you've got a much trickier ratio of cheese and toppings to dough. So it can be very, very hard to reach non-HFSS. So we effectively redesigned every single level of the pizza, nutritionally optimized every single level. And then rebuilt everything back together again with an awful lot of sensory testing. And we had to do harmonised changes with minimal cost as well. So that was just another facet. So also we had to have finance on board. So there was a lot of engagement. But it took a village to get that project across the line.
Sally or anybody else on the panel want to also talk about any learnings or findings or specific examples of how collaboration has sort of helped to get you through some of the challenges that have been faced?
I can talk about a non-collaborative project, actually, which we're sharing with industry. So just after the implementation of the current regs, when stores had changed and products were moved, if you like, and we did quite a small-scale product trial, if you like, in some stores in Leeds, where we looked at the presence of HFSS and in-scope categories on those aisle end and checkouts. And not surprisingly, you know, there was products that probably shouldn't have been there. However, we weren't surprised to find that, because we think the implementation of this is quite tricky in store, and knowing exactly which products in which categories, which I know Lewis showed beautifully on the infographic, and then nutritionally profiling those, so getting your spreadsheet out and doing your A and C point calculations, that's quite a tricky process to undertake, especially at national level. So we weren't surprised to see those areas, but we did produce, not just identifying that, but produce a list of categories that were in and out of scope specifically, as well as some kind of implementation and support systems in that paper. And that's freely available to access for industry, and we've shared that to try to kind of support the spirit of the regulations at supporting public health.
And I suppose leading or looking forward, you know, with the upcoming October deadline, post-October, are you planning to do something similar? Or are there other bodies also actively going to be monitoring and measuring and trying to work out how many are complying and who's not and who's still in the grey area?
So we do plan to repeat that work, yes. Very definitely good. And one of the key outcomes of that work was the kind of mismatch, if you like, between products that were HFSS or not and the number of red traffic lights that they displayed. So these are the customer visibility side. So we really highlighted that, in that consumers see the traffic lights on the front of pack nutrition labelling, and that might be a red traffic light, but what consumers don't see is that the product is a non-HFSS product and perfectly fine to be promoted there and be considered not less healthy. So we had that pointed out. There are teams at Leeds who are working on that question. So what is the impact pre and post on the sales of less healthy products and HFSS products? And that team at Leeds is led by Professor Michelle Morris. So that's real life sales data and industry insight. Yeah, so that's, we're all waiting for that.
Definitely. Coming back to the law, because we all want to do right, don't we? What are the penalties for brands, for companies who don't comply or who do get picked up in the marketplace for?
So it's actually not too bad, which we shouldn't say to this audience, but obviously I do all the regulatory work, you know, be from prison sentences for directors and right through to millions of pounds worth of fines. So here it's kind of reflective of what the ASA have already been doing. So naming and shaming, or asking you to take down that advertising campaign down.
So there's the dirty list.
Exactly that. So it's not like the other set of regs where trading standards can bring an enforcement action against you and you can have a financial penalty, which you would normally expect to see with criminal proceedings. It doesn't fall into that category. As you say, it's that name and shame. Kind of there's the thing is here, it's about doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of noise about this for a very long time. So you just don't want to be the company that falls foul, because as we know, it's been all over the papers and they've already misrepresented it anyway. So if you're the ones that get it wrong in those first couple of months, they're going to love to run a story on it. So the ASA website, not many people will probably be checking it. You know, some of my colleagues like to produce little updates about it all the time. But we're probably in the minority of people checking the ASA website for the name and shame list. But you don't want to fall into the hands of the newspapers, who will make it a much bigger issue and it will run for, you know, a couple of weeks and it just becomes a snowball. So it's more, I say, a PR reputational aspect rather than a criminal sanction aspect. But
and no commercial penalty?
It depends really what your commercial contracts are. So obviously if you've, you know, I won't go in, I'm not a commercial lawyer, thank goodness. I think regulatory laws are excessive enough. But there will be terms and conditions usually within commercial contracts about being compliant and making sure that you know you're producing products that are in line with those conditions. So if you fall foul of those, yes, there could be repercussions from a commercial perspective as well. Obviously, I've got my criminal law hat on, so it's quite nice for me to say to clients for once that they won't be going to prison or facing £1 million worth of fine. But as I say, with anything at the moment, it's the press that follows, and these stories just seem to snowball and become a lot bigger. And as we know, they like to report whatever they want to report. So
excellent, thank you. And just one final question, and again open to the panel, just before we open to the floor for questions. I'll start with yourself, Fionn, if that's okay. Just how are you, I suppose, as an organisation engaging with policymakers to ensure that the implementation phase is both effective
but also practical for the food industry?
So at FDF, we do regularly engage with policymakers. We have regular kind of catch-ups with Department of Health and Social Care and DCMS, which I think is Department of Culture and Media, I think. So we regularly have catch-ups, and that's not just like now when we're going through the preparing for implementation, but from the very beginning in terms of developing policy and kind of sharing that industry perspective, industry feedback, really great industry examples of as well of where you might have challenges in terms of implementing policy or challenges in terms of what industry can and can't feasibly do or where it might need more time, for example. So I think that's a really key way in which we engage with policymakers. One thing we also do is for the past couple of years, we've been having a webinar about understanding HFSS policy, and with that we've had guest speakers from the Welsh and Scottish governments and also from advertising standards as well. So that's a really great kind of webinar where it gives you a bit of a run through and also some kind of key, I guess, upcoming things that you might want to be aware of or developments. So I think that's pretty much how we engage with policy.
Fantastic. Anybody else want to just add to that in terms of what you're doing to keep us clear going forward?
Yeah, I would just say that, so Sally's kind of touched on it, but the implementation has been a bit patchy and enforcement. So we're also, as a business, our CEO's kind of leading some of the messaging on it, which is great because he's very engaged with this topic, but really pushing that there needs to be adequate enforcement. The amount of money that was given for the enforcement of the location restrictions was inadequate, and the Centre for Food Policy out of St George's in London has done some great work on this. The second year, the amount, I think, less than halved. So there really isn't the money there for proper enforcement. And it is that thing of everyone's gone through the work of getting compliant and getting ready for this. Yeah. And therefore, it's quite unfair if the enforcement isn't there and it doesn't do what the spirit of the restriction, which is actually helping to reshape the food environment.
Very good. Brilliant. In 10 seconds, top tip for food brands and manufacturers going forward around the topic of HFSS?
I would say I'm currently trying to wait for that consultation to land. Obviously, we said early spring, so should be any day now. But really keep an eye on that. That's going to be quite good at going down to that basic granular level, giving you examples of what will be caught, what won't be caught, giving you examples of the types of products, you know, trying to put it into real life examples. And then, as I said, just talk to your network. You're all facing the same issues. You know, how have they managed to achieve it? Have, you know, sandboxes together? Has that worked for you? I think there's no better, you know, avenue than just talking to each other. Absolutely. Obviously, there are lawyers, there are people that can help, that if you've got a, you know, a particular nitty problem and you really want to get to grips with it. But as Lauren, as you said earlier on, and Sally as well, you know, you're looking at thousands of product categories, so you don't want to be asking for legal advice on every single area. You want to kind of be, there'll be some that are really grey to you and you don't quite know where they fit. That's the ones where I say reach out and we can really, you know, get to the nitty gritty. They're usually the really hard ones. I think, oh God, that's a head scratcher. But the rest you should, you know, work with your product development teams, work with your marketing teams. Kind of it's got to be a cross collaboration internally.
Fionn, what top tip?
Well, I feel like I have to plug FDF, but we do have a lot of great resources, both for members and non-members, like I mentioned, upcoming webinar, which is on the 24th of June. We also have things like Q&A on categories and scope, but also on general kind of like mechanisms, especially when it comes to advertising. So I think that, and as you said, waiting for the ASA consultation response and guidance, as you say, we should have that any day soon. And hopefully we'll also see some movement when it comes to the discussions between government and ASA on confirming that brand advertising exemption.
Brilliant. Lauren, I appreciate new to role, but what yeah. top tip can you provide?
Mine is the devil's in the detail. Just look at the algorithm. Look at the boundaries. It's, yeah, devil's in the detail. That protein cap is an interesting one. And, yeah, aim high. When I suggested 100% of pizza could be non-HFSS, people thought I'd lost my mind. But, you know, aim high.
Excellent. Sally?
Don't forget about the traffic lights. So that can still be red and non-HFSS.
Thank you very much to all of the panellists.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Ascot in October and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com.